Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favourite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell, filling in for Aggie Tupou this morning. Today on the show, US President Donald Trump has scrapped the scientific finding that underpinned nearly all US climate laws, declaring climate change isn't a public health risk. So what does it mean for the Pacific?
This is just the latest in a concerning trend from the current US administration that is trying to save an industry at the cost of human health and lives.
Coming up, you'll hear from climate experts about how the region will navigate this move from the US. And Solomon Islands anti-corruption watchdog is warning the government not to get comfortable despite an improved score in the latest Corruption Perceptions Index. Also, after controversy over video-assisted referee decisions rocked round one of the OFC Pro League in Auckland, officials say accuracy improved in Port Moresby.
We show the incidents to the match officials. They see what they've done. The idea is to try and create a tool. So we are trying to educate everybody.
But with standards still under scrutiny, a key refereeing presentation is now planned for round three in Melbourne. Those stories and more here on Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, an expert on maritime law says local authorities had no power to detain the ship involved in the latest large cocaine bust near French Polynesia. In their third major seizure in a month, French authorities found 2.4 tons of cocaine on a boat stopped in international waters last week. In a statement announcing the bust, the High Commission of French Polynesia did not specify the ship's name or the flag state. It said the vessel's flag state refused to relinquish jurisdiction to France and so was allowed to continue on its way after the cocaine was dumped into the ocean. Australian National University professor Donald Rothwell says there are only a few specific scenarios in which a ship can be detained on the high seas and its crew arrested.
International law position is that you can only arrest and detain vessels on the high seas if a vessel's engaged in piracy, or if a vessel is engaged in breach of UN Security Council resolutions, which provides states with an ability to arrest and detain a vessel for seeking to avoid those Security Council resolutions. But there are one or two other grounds, but they are the principal grounds. So the mere fact that a vessel is found on the high seas carrying drugs, which are suspected of being part of transnational organised crime, that in itself is not a basis to arrest and detain the vessel, unless for example, the vessel is trafficking drugs in breach of UN Security Council resolutions, which is not the case here. This incident seems to suggest a greater level of cooperation between the French and the flag state. So that's notable. The second point to note is that just from a locational perspective, that the French acknowledge that this interdiction of the vessel took place in the high seas. And from that, of course, it's beyond the territorial sea of French Polynesia, which is the extent of French criminal law as it would apply to this type of conduct. So the fact that the interdiction occurred with the cooperation of the flag state at one level could be seen as something of a joint operation between the French and the flag state. The French have seized and destroyed the drugs, which is what they did in the previous instance. But their inability to prosecute or proceed with any criminal charges is really just an acknowledgement that in this type of situation where a vessel suspected of engaging in drug trafficking is stopped and seized on the high seas, the only state which has an immediate ability to commence criminal proceedings is really the flag state, as opposed to the French in this instance. From a basic international law perspective, the state of registration, which we commonly refer to as the flag state, retains jurisdiction over the vessel wherever that vessel is around the world. So that means that if the French, for example, have gathered evidence with respect to this vessel and its crew engaged in drug trafficking, and if the French, and there's a number of ifs here, if the French have passed on that information to the flag state, well, then the flag state has the ability to commence its own prosecution against the vessel. So there's a number of unknowns there, including who exactly the flag state is, but that's certainly one possibility from the French press release.
So I guess the flag state would have had to have given permission for the French to board in the first place. Is that sort of where the cooperation might have come from?
Yeah, and that's sort of applied. I'm just reading the first sentence. The control carried out on board in agreement with the flag state. So there's clearly some level of interaction, at its highest level. You could say that this is a joint operation. At another level, it was just an operation carried out with the knowledge of the flag state and obviously their agreement for the boarding to occur on the high seas, which is entirely consistent with international law as it applies in the high seas with respect to these types of ships.
With the line where it says the flag state refused to relinquish jurisdiction to France, why would they have done that? Like, why wouldn't they have wanted France to arrest them?
There's a number of policy, political and legal reasons behind that. One is that, and we just don't know, but one is that this might be all part of a much larger investigation that's being carried out by the flag state in collaboration with others with respect to transnational organised drug trafficking at sea. So this might be just part of the process in which the flag state is undergoing, because of course once the French had started their prosecution, if jurisdiction had been relinquished to the French, well then the flag state wouldn't be able to prosecute themselves. So there might be that reason behind it, but there could be a multiple other reasons, and all I can do is just speculate beyond that. Of course, flag states come in all different shapes and sizes, some of whom are incredibly responsible, others less so. So it's difficult to say much more other than the fact that, as I said, that there's some level of cooperation with the flag state here, but who it is, we don't know.
Maritime law expert at the Australian National University, Professor Donald Rothwell, speaking there to Carl Evans. Now, Solomon Islands has recorded a slight improvement in Transparency International's latest Corruption Perceptions Index. The report, based on expert and business views of public sector corruption, shows a one-point improvement for Solomon Islands. Transparency International Solomon Islands Chair Rodney King-Mele says the improvement is welcome, but warns authorities must not become complacent.
Whilst the actual score is an improvement from last year's score of 43, it's important to note that it's a one-point improvement, which is that's a step in the right direction. But the point that needs to be made is that a one-point improvement when we are still below 50 is we need to accept that we can't be complacent about the issue of corruption. We're still below 50, so the country is still perceived as somewhere that still has persistent serious challenges in relation to corruption issues.
So what do you see as the biggest challenge facing Solomon Islands as far as corruption is concerned?
Everyone can and can see our recent challenges in the area of corruption. We've had recently the major health scandal. There's also the issue about economic stimulus package funds being misused. There's ongoing corruption issues in logging and the mining sector. There's also, when election time comes around, there's also all the corruption issues surrounding elections, bribery and vote buying, all those issues. They are the challenges that the country currently faces in fighting corruption.
Now, Rodney, what about the business community? How should they see Solomon Islands Corruption Perceptions Index, and what could they do to help improve the country's core?
In terms of the business community, I think businesses should view the Corruption Perception Index as a risk assessment tool, and the higher score there signals stronger institutions, reduce corruption risks, okay. So I think in terms of the business community, the call would be that they refuse to engage in corrupt practices. They demand transparency from the authorities, from those in positions of power, and that's, I think, the important call to the business community, that they don't entertain corrupt practices.
And to the public in Solomon Islands, what would you want them to do?
To the general public, the call would be that we are all equally responsible in fighting corruption. And I think the important call is when, election time comes around, we stop voting for the sake of money. We stop selling. The public should, stop selling their votes, as it were. Stop accepting bribes from candidates or entertaining offers of bribes. The public can demand accountability from those in power. One of the important points to note is that when members of the public, we don't speak out and we accept corruption as just the normal way of doing things, that's when corruption thrives. So we need to start speaking out and refusing to accept corrupt practices.
And Rodney King-Mele speaking out there to Sam Seke from the ABC's One Talk program.
Hold the front page!
Now let's get some news headlines from around the region, starting with Matangi Tonga, who is reporting that Tonga's police chief says the kingdom's illicit drug problem is not as widespread as perceived. Police Commissioner Jeff Turner has said the country's illicit drug problem is not at the scale that some people think it is. He told Matangi Tonga Online that while large quantities of drugs are moving through the Pacific, they're mostly being transshipped and not destined for Tonga's domestic market. Commissioner Turner says police are actively dealing with the issue and closely monitoring drug trends, and he's proposed wastewater testing to the Tongan government to better measure the true scale of drug use. If approved, the drug testing could begin at police stations as part of that monitoring effort. Over to Vanuatu, where Vanuatu's Daily Post is reporting that the country's whooping cough death toll has risen now to 7. 6 of the deaths occurred in Tana and 1 in Shefa province. 3 of the deaths were babies. Whooping cough is a highly contagious and potentially dangerous respiratory infection, and the country's health ministry is reminding the public to follow preventative measures against the cough. In an update from early February, the ministry said cases were declining from their peak in 2025, but that the outbreak is still ongoing. And some news from here in Australia. Former NRL player Matt Utai is hospitalised after a shooting outside his Sydney West home. The former Tigers winger was shot in the shoulder and leg just after 6 a.m. yesterday and has undergone surgery. Police have been told he was shot outside a home on the street by occupants of an SUV before they fled the scene. And the 44-year-old was taken to hospital after sustaining multiple gunshot wounds. The ABC understands that Mr. Utai's son, Isaiah, is an associate of the warring Al-Madine crime family, and his son was targeted in two organized crime-style attacks in 2025.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
My name is Jordan Fennon. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Wednesday morning. Now, Donald Trump says it's a scam to say that climate change is a threat to public health. So the US president has killed off a scientific finding that says it is. The so-called endangerment finding was the basis for nearly all climate laws in the US, and it underpinned federal limits on greenhouse gas emissions, determining that they posed a threat to public health and welfare. Its removal marks the most significant step yet in dismantling US climate regulations, with vehicle emission standards also scrapped. Lucy Cooper reports.
It's a move that's angered Pacific climate campaigners.
This is just the latest in a concerning trend from the current US administration that is trying to save an industry at the cost of human health and lives.
We're tired of receiving bad news, really, on climate. And the US, unfortunately, we're seeing that constantly, very frequently, under the current administration.
When US President Donald Trump walked into a press conference in the White House last week and told reporters, "This is a big one if you're into environment," he wasn't kidding.
We are officially terminating the so-called endangerment finding, a disastrous Obama-era policy that severely damaged the American auto industry and massively drove up prices for American consumers.
In the space of a few minutes, with the belief that climate change is a con job, the president announced to the world that his administration was revoking the basis for nearly all climate laws in the US.
Over the generations, fossil fuels have saved millions of lives and lifted billions of people out of poverty and all over the world. And you see it with the blackouts all over where they don't use it, where they went to wind. And people are dying because there was no air conditioning or there was no heating. And yet this radical rule became the legal foundation for the Green New Scam, one of the greatest scams in history.
Known as the endangerment finding, it was issued by the Environmental Protection Agency in 2009. It led to the determination that greenhouse gases warmed the earth and endangered the health and welfare of current and future generations. It's since served as the legal basis for federal climate regulations, setting limits on greenhouse gas emissions. Now, the EPA is rescinding the finding under the Trump administration. So what happens when one of the world's largest polluters gives up on reducing greenhouse gas emissions? Here's Christian Downey, professor in the School of Regulation and Global Governance at the Australian National University.
I don't think there's a president in US history that's really presented, you know, such a threat to global efforts to cut pollution as Trump has. But I think legal challenges will come thick and fast. We'll see environmental groups, we'll see Democratic-controlled states like California mount legal cases to challenge this repeal.
If litigation fails and the US doesn't cut pollution, Mr. Downey said, as the second largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, international climate goals are going to be further out of reach. For Jacinta Fa'amau, a campaigner for environmental organisation 350 Pacific, the announcement is a blow to Pacific communities.
For us in the Pacific, who contribute only around 0.02% of global carbon emissions, you know, Pacific countries, you know, have been carrying the weight of global climate leadership. You know, while the Trump administration can manipulate their, you know, scientific agencies, it can never suppress the truth that ordinary people in the Pacific, in the US and around the world are paying the real price for big oil profits and other fossil fuels. Lives are being lost, homes are being destroyed and costs are soaring.
Ms. Fa'amau said whilst on paper it seems to be a losing battle, she's holding out hope.
It can feel defeating and it is a huge delay on trying to build towards the future that we all want. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that this is a life and death situation, and also remind ourselves that there are incredible people and communities around the world who are still pushing through and battling the crisis regardless of these political situations.
The announcement has coincided with the news that the US is urging countries to pressure Vanuatu to withdraw a UN draft resolution supporting a landmark International Court of Justice ruling that countries have a legal obligation to act on climate change. The campaign, which sparked the finding, was initiated by the group Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change. Vishal Prasad is its director.
It's very unfortunate and really a dangerous step taken by the US government at a time when the world needs to be ramping up climate action.
He said he was disappointed the US had decided to repeal the endangerment finding.
It is something that really puts the world, puts the US, the world, and particularly small island developing states in a lot of trouble, because we now have to, in our fight for climate justice, this does not help us. And so it really is unfortunate and very disappointing that the US has decided to do this counter to the science and the law.
Like Jacinta Fa'amau, Mr. Prasad holds out hope.
This is not just an issue for the Pacific. This is an issue for the whole world, and parts of the US are already seeing some of the very severe impacts of climate change. Communities are already witnessing this. So we think it's just a matter of time before the US realizes that it needs to act on climate change, and we're hoping that sooner rather than later.
Back in the US, Mr. Trump says the announcement is the single largest deregulatory action in American history, and he's hoping fossil fuel-based industries like America's petrol car manufacturers will flourish again.
We're repealing the ridiculous endangerment finding and terminating all additional green emission standards imposed unnecessarily on vehicle models and engines between 2012 and 2027 and beyond. This action will save American consumers trillions of dollars and will lower the average cost of a new vehicle by close to $3,000.
That report there from Lucy Cooper. Now, while it is a domestic US decision, as we've just heard, its ripple effects could be felt far beyond America's borders into the Pacific. And Dr. Wesley Morgan is a research associate with the University of New South Wales Institute for Climate Risk and Response, and he joins me this morning. Wesley, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Now, tell me, Wesley, how significant is this decision by the US to repeal this?
Oh, look, this is a significant decision because it will slow the shift away from fossil fuel technologies, which pollute the climate, and towards clean energy technology in the United States. And the US is the world's biggest emitter over time and is the second largest emitter today. So, you know, it's significant for global efforts to cut climate pollution. And that matters very much for Pacific Island countries. We heard in your intro there that, you know, climate change is a real threat to island nations. Pacific leaders have said that climate change is their single greatest security threat for decades. And so, you know, they're looking for wealthy countries, major polluters like the United States, to be limiting climate pollution. But unfortunately, the US President Donald Trump, he's a climate denier, right? So for a long time now, he's just said that climate change is a hoax and he has no faith in the science. And under Trump's leadership, the Republican Party in the United States has become ever more radicalized. So he's now implementing an ideological agenda that's really out of step with the science, it's out of step with international law, and it's out of step, actually, with global market trends. So, you know, the US has become an outlier. I mean, Trump has withdrawn the United States from the Paris Agreement, but not one country has followed that decision to leave the Paris Agreement. So The vast majority of countries, they do accept the science of climate change. They remain committed to cutting climate pollution and shifting to clean energy technologies. And so if you take just one example, China, which is the world's biggest polluter at the moment, China is going in the opposite direction to what Trump is. So China is now the world's largest manufacturer of clean energy technologies. So wind, solar, electric vehicles, batteries, these are the things that are going to power tomorrow's economy around the world. And China is now the world's biggest car maker and the world's biggest car exporter. And more than half of all new cars in China and more than half of all new cars in Europe, actually, are powered by batteries, not by oil. So, you know, Trump thinks he can hold back the tide when it comes to this global shift to clean energy. But really, all he will do is slow the shift in the United States, and that will come at great economic costs to the United States.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. With this endangerment finding that came about in 2009, how did America respond to that over the past 16 years in how it tackled climate change?
Well, so the endangerment finding is really a statement of the science by the federal government, which, you know, under the Obama administration. It serves as the legal basis for US regulations to limit climate pollution from cars, from factories, from power plants. And so, you know, in 2009, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, reviewed the science and found that climate pollution, particularly greenhouse gases that come from burning coal, oil, and gas, is the chief cause of climate change and presents a danger to human health and welfare. And that's an established scientific fact. And that became the legal basis for regulating those emissions in order to avoid that damage and harm to human health and welfare. So subsequent regulations, such as those that limit pollution from the tailpipes of cars, for example, were based on that scientific finding. And Trump, in repealing it, he's effectively, you know, giving a license to pollute. And he thinks that's a good idea.
Yeah, so like you say, as it's been revoked, so is it all bets are off, as much pollution as possible, it's okay, factories can pollute, cars can pollute. Is that sort of where America's heading at the moment?
Well, yes, but there's a little bit of detail in the way. So this decision will be challenged in courts in the United States. So it'll be challenged by environmental groups, possibly by by Democrats in different states. The Democrat governor of California, Gavin Newsom, he is kind of tipped as a front runner for the next presidential race. He says that Donald Trump is a wholly owned subsidiary of the U.S. oil and gas industry and that he wants to take the U.S. back to the 19th century. So while you have China making this big bet on the shift to electrification, you have Trump trying to reinvest in old technologies in fossil fuels. And Newsom, he really has a point. So Trump, in the lead up to his most recent presidential election, he hosted a whole host of U.S. oil executives at his at Mar-a-Lago, at his home, and he said to them, look, if you donate $1 billion to my presidential campaign, then I'll enact policies that help you. And at the moment, they're getting real value for money. So he doesn't believe in climate science, and he has said very openly that he's making these decisions on behalf of the vested interests of fossil fuel companies.
Now, you mentioned earlier that this all sits in a whole bunch of moves that the US has made under the Trump administration to strip away its climate obligations, like it stepped away from the Paris Treaty. But as you say, America is also out of step with the rest of the world. The rest of the world has not followed suit. So from your perspective, how does this play out for the Pacific moving forward?
So for the Pacific, the Pacific has long had been stuck with the science, right? So the Pacific has this leadership role in global efforts to tackle climate change because, as a block of countries, the Pacific has really just called on all countries to respect the science. That's why we have this global goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees above the long-term average. The Pacific played a crucial role securing the Paris Agreement. And then in the last couple of years, the Pacific has played a crucial role clarifying the international law obligations of all countries, right? So, you know, the Pacific Island students and then the country Vanuatu led a diplomatic campaign to have the legal obligations of countries clarified by the world's highest court. And last year, the International Court of Justice issued a ruling that found that all countries need to move away from fossil fuel consumption and fossil fuel production precisely because it pollutes the climate and damages the Earth's climate system. And so for the Pacific, you know, I think it's important not to lose hope with this decision because Trump might be able to slow the clean energy transition in the United States for a little while, but the global trend, you know, the mega trend globally is bigger than the MAGA trend in the US. And globally, investment in clean energy technology overtook investment in fossil fuels a decade ago. And in the past year was about double investment in fossil fuels. So the Pacific has a key role to play, continuing to fight for the science, continuing to call on countries to fulfill their legal obligations to deal with climate pollution. And, you know, it's really acting on behalf of all of us and future generations.
You mentioned there the International Court of Justice advisory finding on climate change that came about last year. Vanuatu is currently working at the UN General Assembly, on a draft resolution to have this accepted by the Assembly at the moment. The US has come out and pushed for countries not to support Vanuatu in this. And we heard yesterday on Pacific Beat from Vanuatu's climate envoy, Ralph Roggenvanu, who says a similar thing happened at the International Maritime Organization, where there was a push from the US not to move towards climate change efforts. And people did back down then. Other countries did back down. It's happening again with this ICJ advisory. How could this all play out, and what does it signal about the global politics of climate accountability at the moment?
Yeah, look, there is a danger there that the United States is throwing its weight around to undermine multilateral cooperation. You know, it's shocking behaviour at the IMO to nix a levy on climate pollution associated with shipping. And on the ICJ, Vanuatu and other countries from around the world have proposed a UN General Assembly resolution that would welcome, you know, the clarification of legal obligations by the International Court of Justice and also strengthen climate action in line with those legal obligations. But Vanuatu's move has infuriated the Trump administration, who has written to all of their officials, you know, through a memo at the State Department, calling on their officials and envoys around the world to try and head this resolution off. But this is actually the latest chapter in quite a long fight, because Vanuatu was the first country in the world back in the early 90s to call for major polluters to pay for the loss and damage caused by their climate pollution. So Vanuatu was actually the first to put the phrase loss and damage on the table. And so the whole time that the world has been discussing what to do about climate change, Vanuatu has been pressing that. And the United States has been trying to head off any discussion about loss and damage to avoid any culpability for the damage caused by climate pollution. And the reason why is because the US has contributed more to climate change than any other country. So, you know, looking at the whole history of climate pollution. And this latest example is a continuation of that. And we shall see in coming weeks, you know, whether Vanuatu and other countries from around the world are able to find a UN General Assembly resolution that will be supported by a majority of countries. I think it's significant that small island states are upholding a rules-based global order, and really the country that was at the heart of that global order for the much of the past 80 years since the Second World War is now really a danger to that order and is undermining international rules and norms. So all power to Vanuatu, really.
Well, Dr. Wesley Morgan, thank you so much for joining me this morning and talking through all of that.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Dr. Wesley Morgan, Research Associate with the University of New South Wales Institute for Climate Risk and Response. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Still to come on the show, Vanuatu's financial regulator says the country has taken an important step by joining a major grouping of its international counterparts. And controversy over video-assisted referee decisions have rocked the OFC Pro League. That's coming up.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. You're with me, Jordan Fennell, here on this Wednesday morning. Now, Vanuatu's financial regulator says the country has taken an important step by joining a major grouping of its international counterparts. The Vanuatu Financial Services Commission has become an associate member of the International Organization of Securities Commissions, IOSCO, the body that sets rules for financial markets worldwide. VFC Commissioner Brandon Correa says it signals that Vanuatu is serious about transparency, investor protection, and aligning with international standards. And he tells our reporter Lily Rose Wellwell it also comes ahead of a November review of how the country tackles money laundering and terrorism financing.
It is a big thing for us. Everybody hears about ISCO. It is a prestigious international body. It is basically setting standards and all this. And to become an associate member of the International Organization of Security, which is ISCO, it is a significant milestone for Vanuatu. The bottom line is everybody wants to become a member, but to be accepted to become an associate member, it shows our commitment, you know, Vanuatu, to align with international standards of security regulation and investors' protection. And it's not an easy task. We have to demonstrate. And we're just so happy that, you know, over the process, we are able to demonstrate that while it doesn't immediately change our market operations, you know, business as usual and all this, by being an associate member and being part of the ISCO, overall it strengthens our credibility and importantly builds the investors' confidence, meaning others or investors globally will see, oh, it's Vanuatu is meeting all these standards. It's like an audit check. We can deal with them. We are confident they can do business with the better regulators and all this. They're part of this international body, which is we can trust. It also connects Vanuatu to the global network of regulators, meaning we're not standalone. We are now part of these regulators, and it gives us access to shared expertise and best practice, something that we don't have before. Now we can cross-reference, we can talk with other regulators similar within the industry, and it gives us a better footing in terms of doing our job and learning from the best practice. Global market should care because our progress in this area signals that Vanuatu is serious about maintaining transparency, integrity, and responsible financial oversight as we continue to develop our financial sector. So that it is very important. We have faced challenges in the past. The fact that we are able to demonstrate our ability to comply, now it places us in a better footing. So it does matter. It does matter big time. Vanuatu has gone through a lot in terms of what the global market, the globe has seen in the finance sector, how Vanuatu is practicing all this. Becoming a member now it does add a lot to our reputation and what we do in Vanuatu in terms of the financial sector.
Vanuatu has faced regulatory scrutiny in the past. Is this Securities Commission milestone in a genuine turning point in international confidence or largely symbolic at this stage?
Becoming an associate member, it's much more than a symbolic step. I mean, it reflects real progress Vanuatu is taking in strengthening its regulatory standards and aligning with global best practice. That is very, very important in our effort. But not particularly PFSC, we do acknowledge the challenge the country faced in the past, but having part, you know, associate member now, it's a milestone. Vanuatu wants to show to the international community that Vanuatu, it is serious about reform, transparency, and investors' protection. It's not for just now, but it is part of an ongoing journey towards building lasting confidence. Like I said, not for today, but for the future of our financial sector, because we have come under a lot of scrutiny, and this is a very good development for Vanuatu.
This recognition comes ahead of Vanuatu's mutual evaluation by the Financial Action Task Force. How much weight will this IOSCO associate membership carry when assessors review your AML and counterterrorism financing frameworks?
We see this as a very good progress. For Vanuatu, it's being part of ISCO associate member is a positive signal. It shows that Vanuatu is serious about meeting international regulatory and compliance standards. Yes, we acknowledge that the FATF mutual evaluation focuses specifically on our anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing framework. But the ISCO membership and our recognition, it complements this overall work. It demonstrates that our broader financial regulatory system is becoming stronger, more transparent, and more better aligned with global standards norms. It certainly reinforces the credibility and direction of the reform we're undertaking. So this is, like we stated, this is a very, very positive development for us. Joining ISCO is a prestige organization, and certainly this will position us better in terms of what FATF is doing at the moment in recognition of Vanuatu's effort.
The head of Vanuatu's Financial Services Commission, Branan Karay, speaking to Lily Rose Wellwell there. To sports news now, and after round one of the OFC Pro League in Auckland, soccer fans across the Pacific were up in arms about decisions made or not made by VAR, the video assistant referee. But the heat seems to have died down a little during round two in Port Moresby, and Pacific Beat has been told that the accuracy rate in decision making was above the 92% mark set in New Zealand. However, OFC's head of refereeing, Kevin Stoltenkamp, says there is still room for improvement, and he has plans for his department to make an important presentation to the teams during round three in Melbourne later this week.
We try to make sure that we put the pressure on our match officials to perform, because we want the teams, because it's new in the region, to understand what's happening. So we're not going to accept 92. I know we're asking for a lot, but this is what we want. We want to get as many as possible correct. And it's all about, once we can get this education going with the teams as well, with the spectators, I think they'll have a better understanding of the VAR process and protocols. And then maybe we could have better comments coming back on the performance of the match officials.
And the presentation that you're planning to make to the teams during round three in Melbourne, will that be showing incidents from the first two rounds and explaining why those decisions were made?
But also showing the ones that we got wrong, because I think that's the important thing, because we use those to also train the match officials, the VMOs, because an error might have had an impact on the game, but it also has an impact on the match officials, because it shows them what we need to improve on. And it's no excuse. We're not going to compare ourselves to other leagues of the world. It's no use saying, oh, well, they got it wrong here. No. We have to look at where we are and try and improve that.
Going back to the PNG circuit, Circuit 2 of the Pro League, I think from a disciplinary refereeing point of view, the game that clearly stood out was the one involving Vanuatu United in South Melbourne. Vanuatu ended up with 8 players on the field, 3 red cards. Their coach was red carded as well. Did VAR have a role to play in any of those decisions? And if so, are you satisfied that on an occasion like that, that the officials got things right?
Yeah, the first incident, unfortunately, was a clear red card. And I think as a result of that, then you had the coach being sent off. Then you had the 2 other incidents were second yellow cards. So the referees got them right. The first one was serious foul play, studs on the ankle. Even with or without VAR, I think the referee needed to get that. The coach coming on to the field of play, what was said to the referee? Red card, no option, because that's the new laws coming through FIFA. And the second 2 was a challenge outside the penalty area, which would have been a yellow card, but that player was already on the yellow card. So VAR doesn't get involved in that. And then the 3rd one was a hand to the neck, chest area, which had been a yellow card. And it was a second yellow card. So VAR wouldn't be involved for that because VAR is not involved with yellow card offences, which might come into effect next year. So it was just the first one.
So in that sense, you're happy that what occurred on the field that day, nobody made any mistakes? Because the problem is, of course, that spectators, either at the ground or watching on FIFA Plus, looking at 3 players sent off plus the coach, they're going to start asking questions. It's inevitable, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you see, it's typical. Some of the people I've spoken to, just why you got a red card for that? No, it was a second yellow. VAR cannot get involved for yellow cards. Like there were incidents where, from a technical perspective, we would have wanted the referee to give a yellow card, but VAR cannot tell the referee to give a yellow card. So those are coaching when the referees come off. We look at it and say, in our opinion, you've missed this because there's a foot on the ankle, but fortunately enough, the player's foot hit the ground first and then made contact. So then VAR cannot get involved in that.
And overall, you spoke after round 1 in New Zealand about the fact that just as the players, most of them are new to professionalism, same thing applies to the officials. Are you finding now that those working with VAR are more comfortable with the technology and also knowing exactly when they should intervene and when they shouldn't?
Yes, they are. And we show the incidents to the match officials. They see what they've done. The idea is to try and create a pool. So we are trying to educate everybody. Quite honestly, match officials want to be on the field of play. So what we are trying to do is we're trying to make sure that we have a balance of good match officials on the field of play and excellent video match officials in the VAR center to have a balance between the two. Because it's important that they work together as a team. They talk to each other before a match. They know exactly what each other is looking for. I mean, our job by having our instructors is to make sure they follow the correct protocols, and then they're marked on that.
And last time we spoke, you mentioned the technology that you're using is being looked at by other associations around the world because of your use, as I understand it, of the internet. Can you tell me what OFC is doing that is different from what other confederations are doing?
In this part of the world, it's all about costs. We're the only confederation that did not have VAR, so we made approach to FIFA because the federations themselves have to drive VAR and the costs around it. So what we do is we use the internet to send the signal back to our VAR center. And in this way, it is cheaper and then we can get it. Because for us, we would have to send a server to each of the respective countries. We would have to freight it. And then we don't know what's the customs like and we'll get stuck there. So we looked at an option which would work for us. And knowing the nature of the Pacific, we found out that the internet was the best option. And that's how we work it. And it's a much cheaper option. However, we find that the problem is that we found like in the stadium we're going to use, they must have internet coming into it. And that was in some of the stadiums in Australia was a massive thing for us, which was quite surprising, not having internet coming in and then getting out. So in Australia, we'll be on site. We are not sending the signals back to New Zealand.
Interesting that OFC have found a cheaper way to run VAR in the Pacific, but one that they can't use in Australia. Well, that was Kevin Stoltenkamp, the Confederation's head of refereeing, talking there to Richard Hewitt. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat this morning. A quick look back at our main story today. A maritime law expert says local authorities had no power to detain the ship involved in the latest large cocaine bust near French Polynesia. Thank you so much for your company this morning. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. But stay tuned now to ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily.